You're listening to Confessing Animals with Jen Harris and Vanessa Arrico, rebel poets, real rebels, really talking poets, rebelling and listening.
Okay, don't interrupt me.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Confessing Animals podcast. I'm Jen Harris.
And I'm Vanessa Arrico.
And today we are joined by Erin Jean McGrain, or Erin J. McGrain. And Erin is a writer, a musician, an actress, a public speaker, and a professional development mentor. Notably, Erin appears in the Oscar-nominated film Up in the Air alongside George Clooney. She has toured the U.S. extensively with her musical group Victor and Penny and co-founded an annual performance, creativity, and songwriting event. Erin was honored in KC Magazine's The 100 People Who Make Life Better in KC, and is proud to say she misspent her youth singing in a rock band. You can check her out at erinjmcgrain.com, on Insta at the same handle, and Facebook, erin.mcgrain.18. So today we have interviewed Erin, and she rejected the notions of revenge and redemption.
It was so brilliant. I love that she was like, nope, came with my own ideas.
Yeah, I'm going to call these things other things. Which you're going to have to listen to the podcast for, because it's her take on it was super unique. And every single episode this season, I think we can't possibly explore this any differently. Like, obviously, there will be somebody who overlaps with somebody else in their belief system of it or their avoidance of it. And Erin brought another gray area that I hadn't thought about at all. Like, the possibility of these two things not even entering someone's conversation and seeing exactly. them totally differently was absolutely bizarre to me.
I think it's a really helpful reframing of the concept of revenge and redemption. And I think it's more inviting for a lot of people. So, yeah, this, I didn't anticipate where this conversation was going. And I'm just really, I'm happy with everything we talked about. It was super relatable. Her voice is incredible. I mean, this is a professional woman. Like, she's bringing it.
George Clooney. She's been on stages everywhere, burlesque, and she's been in a theater, and she's an actress, and she's a performer. I mean, yeah, she's done everything I think you can do with art so far, and I'm very excited about it.
I love her storytelling too. You know, as I hear in workshop, but I felt like this piece that she brought and what we talked about was a different side of Erin that I haven't got to see before, which is really exciting. And like, which is the whole point of doing this podcast with our writing fellows, just like, so we can all like get to know each other better. And we did a deep dive and it was super relatable.
I am that I guess leads us into what y'all are going to hear before you hear the interview, which is that Erin is working on a body of work that is tentatively titled Sounds Like a Feeling. And she has shared with us a piece of work from that collection called Tossed and Found. So you're going to hear Tossed and Found, and then we'll jump into the interview. So thank you all for being here and listening with us on Confessing Animals podcast. You ready to get into this interview?
Let's do it.
The dream I'm having ends abruptly, and I'm awake. My heart is a bird, frantic flutter in a bone cage, hurry hammer in a bone barrel. My heart is a furry small thing, panic panting in a sinewy box, scurry, worry, round, tender, tinder in a tendon wheel. My heart is a fish, plunge, propel, swim or die, tread or dive, who still doesn't know how wet she is or the depth of the water. Up, sit up, sweat, up, up, up from the dream, up from the down doom, up, 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 up from the down cycle, down doom, dream, up, 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 up. I am afraid. I am not afraid. I am afraid. I am not. I shake my head to scatter the doom. Where is the calm to steady my hands? untie me. I lie back down, old cold sweat on smooth blue sheets, tears fisted from my eyes. Breathe. Breathe. I feel the hands of my grandmothers upon me. They are here with me, warm hands on my hot heart, cool palms on my fever forehead. Here, in the soft rosy gold of my wedding ring, that was their wedding ring, passed down through the daughters, passed down to me, now resting on my own thick-veined, grateful hand. When I am sleepless, the veil is thin. With my eyes closed, I see the brides, the old women I know from photos, and those I knew in my youth, radiant in theirs. When the ring was young, and so were they, I speak their names. Katie, Beulah, Gladys, 1875, 1902, 1929. I can feel them in the stitches on the worn quilt I've tossed off, rumpled scraps of florals and stripes, made for me by a grandmother I loved as my own blood, cut and sewn from family remnants saved over a lifetime, a crazy quilt of a boy's torn pajamas, a mother's tired house dress, the last of a well-worn work shirt, nothing wasted, nothing lost, but all given second life. I pull it back around me. My thin-voiced grandmother sings, "Birdie on my windowsill with its little yellow bill." I feel her smile. I feel her sharp nails stroke the thin-skinned hollow inside my elbow, where the blood of all my grandmothers flows in a purple-blue roadmap to my soul, and the heart of my mother beats without ending.
I just want to jump in. Let's start with Tossed and Found. First of all, like, it's so professional. It's an incredible recording. It's incredible reading. And you're making us all look bad. So,
yeah, don't you know about our audio quality budget here, Erin?
Right. Like, I want you to tell us about this piece. And then, like, tell us, did, like, our theme of revenge and redemption, did that play a role at all in this piece of writing?
Also, okay. Thank you for honoring us with sending this to us, because I know we're debuting it and I'm incredibly grateful, because what an incredibly powerful piece.
Thank you. All right. I'll talk about the piece. So that's one piece in a larger work called Sounds Like a Feeling. And it really sprang out of a super dark place I was in for a year and a half or 2 years. I think that's when we were first really getting to be friends, Jen, was I was deep in the middle of that. And I was having just chronic anxiety. I was having panic attacks. Insomnia, just acute depression. This was, you know, part COVID, part life change, part financial stress, just like everything. And I just had this, like, I literally went down into my basement in my house. We bought this house that had this finished basement. And I literally went down in that basement and spent about a year and a half down there. And out of these anxiety dreams I was having, I would wake up in the middle of the night and I would go upstairs and I would just write. And I wrote and wrote and wrote, and I just filled a notebook with pieces. And so then I started to work on this thinking that it would be performed. Of course, this started right before COVID. So it was intended to be a live performance piece. So if you can imagine that, like, done live on stage with incredible lighting, like maybe with Quixotic or something like that, where there would be physical movement, but I would be off stage somewhere in the dark somewhere reading it live. The music would be played probably on the track, and then there would be live, like, motion and lights and graphics that to give the multi-sensory feel of what it's like to have acute anxiety, a panic attack, to feel out of control of your emotions and your body. So the music was composed by my husband, Jeff. He just really felt these pieces really resonated with him. And he said, I'd like to try to put something behind that. So he started working on it and then we would kind of work together. So I would say, at the top, I want it to be like the way my brain sounds, like what does a feeling sound like? So at the top of that piece, when it goes, that's what it's like when I wake up from this terrible dream, you're in this nightmare place of you're just like literally sweating and I'm panting. And I wanted it to feel like that. And then it stops, you know, and then that sort of feeling like, so I just felt like he was able to capture each one of those feelings so well. And I think both of you have probably had anxiety and panic attacks before and know that feeling of, and I hope that's what it sounds like to help. My hope is that people that could hear this, if you've never had that, you have maybe some empathy for people that do have acute anxiety, depression, insomnia, because it's a physical thing. It's not just in your head. It's a whole physical, all-consuming thing. So he started working on those tracks, you know, a year and a half ago or so. Probably, and did most of it in the studio. But the strings that you hear live, those are done by the men from Quixotic, Ben and Shane. So they did the strings live. So Jeff wrote and composed that and orchestrated it. And then they sent tracks in. So that a lot of that was done during COVID, you know, remotely. So that was really kind of a cool thing. And then I just recorded the vocal Monday, just a couple of days ago for you guys. So the music had been done, but I hadn't done the vocal yet. So I'm excited about it.
It's such an extraordinary piece of work. And first of all, I can't imagine a life that doesn't involve anxiety. Like who is living out in this world, no matter what your belief system is, that doesn't feel anxiety's breath on its neck on a regular basis? Like
especially now. I mean, I feel like we've all been living in high anxiety since COVID, really. Well, maybe even since 2016 would be, I think, when my anxiety started.
Absolutely. But that sensory experience that you're talking about and the, I love that you're maintaining this title of Sounds Like a Feeling. And I love it on such a personal level because I know Vanessa's partner to a musician also. So her work has that, she has that extra fun you both do of being able to try and communicate across mediums with somebody who's kind of like intimately required to hear you out, which I'm super jealous of. Because I, you know, when I had the book debut a couple of years ago, I was paired with a jazz group to try and make music for my release, right?
It was wonderful. I loved it.
Thank you. Thank you.
It was amazing.
I remember torturing them, trying to describe emotions as music because I can't read music. I don't know anything about music. And I looked at Eddie Moore and I was like, it sounds like the ocean. And then he would play the ocean. I go, the sad ocean. And he would play the sad ocean. I'm like, the sad ocean in the morning, though. Like, get it? Like, I couldn't. Where is the language for that when you cannot denote it in the language in which it's spoken, you know?
It's so hard. But I think you touched on that since we have intimate relationships with these partners who see us through these emotions. They are very familiar with them as well. And as musicians and artists themselves, I think they are able to tap into that. Even if they're not experiencing the same thing, I think they're able to relate in a way, even just witnessing us, right? And you did such a good job. I mean, I suffer from very bad panic anxiety disorder and have since high school. And so the first section in this piece you did, it's kind of like that frantic and it's like, it's the up. And I'm like, it has that feeling of like, it's kind of frantic. It's kind of panty. Like nothing is like, it's not a full sentence. It's very kind of choppy. And like, it's like this quick feeling, right? It's like this, the racingness. And
racing. Like,
yeah, racing. Oh, God. And you end that first section with, I am not, K-N-O-T. And I listened to it before I read it on the page, and I love that it was K-N-O-T. And I am not. Not, you didn't say, like, I'm in a knot, or I am the knot, or anything like that. It's just like, I am not. And I loved the double entendre of the use of the word not. And, like, that was so powerful to me.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, talking about, you asked about how this piece fits into the theme of redemption and revenge. And I'm excited to talk about that because I thought a lot about both of those words since you asked me to be on the show. And in my life, I'm not sure that either of those words, I feel particularly motivated to them. I would redefine them, how they play out in my life. Instead of revenge and redemption, I would say punishment and forgiveness. This is how those words feel to me, because the only person I ever want revenge on is myself, or the only person I ever punish is myself. I remember when I was a kid, my mom said to me, "Erin, I never ever want to punish you because you're so hard on yourself that it hurts me to punish you, because if I did something wrong, I was the first to know." And she didn't have to punish me because I just suffered myself so much for it. And so much of this depression and anxiety and, I'll tell you, I've had body dysmorphia and all different kinds of eating disorders when I was younger. Have had a lot of things that I've worked through over many, many years. And so much of it is just an unkindness to myself. So for me, really, the idea of redemption comes in forgiveness. And the idea of revenge is really punishment. I'm trying very hard to stop punishing myself and to love myself and to forgive myself. So that's where that redemption and revenge comes in, the way that I filter those through my vernacular. And then when I looked at that, pretty much everything I ever write has both of those things in it. It's just a constant. It's just like this poem in that those two opposites just reside in me at all times. Just there is a duality about my personality. Not that I have two personalities, but there's just a, I suppose there isn't everybody, right? It's yin and yang, but mine seem quite divided at times. And I think this poem really demonstrate that, because in the span of just a few minutes, that was a real experience. That was a real morning, just one morning. And that's how I went from this panic to this sense of safety and forgiveness, self-forgiveness and love and acceptance, all in a matter of a few minutes. But it's a lot of work to work through that. And that's just a little microcosm of where I am in my life right now.
I think I just, go back to the multitudes, that we all contain.
Oh, we contain multitudes. Absolutely.
Right? So it's like we've been carrying Whitman with us since season one. And it's like to start out with that frantic panic and then to end with like the thinned voice grandma singing and you're in a completely different state by the end. And that's such a real experience, because I mean sometimes it could last an hour for me, sometimes it's 3 months for me, but like that's the extremes you're going through. Like, something is not okay. And then for a moment, like sometimes you come down and like, okay, something's okay right now, but then it's not going to be okay again, right? Like it is this constant roller coaster.
Yes, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. And so you strive to just get somewhere more okay than the panic, And I certainly, even now, like 2 years later, I see this is 2019. I'm looking at my little copyright thing on there, it's like, I'm in such a different, better place now, even just a couple of years later, just hugely different place. And that's, of course, going back into therapy and, lots of things, all the things that we do for self-care. And I love that this is also Mental Health Month, because I think mental health is just health to me. Like, I don't know why we make a distinguishing different or why there's any stigma about that. If I broke my wrist, I would certainly not feel ashamed to tell you that I'd broken my wrist. So if I'm experiencing a period of high anxiety for a lot of real reasons, it's not like you make up the world stress and COVID and the election of 2016, like that all actually happened. So, this was also, I'm thinking about all the rioting and the Me Too movement. And I had started to explore some of those experiences in my own life. So that's kind of more about redemption. Again, to me, it's about not revenge or redemption, but forgiveness or acceptance. I think these are all shades of the same kinds of feelings, but, and some of that, before I could get to that acceptance or forgiveness part, there was a lot of anxiety.
Well, and I think that's the power of this particular way in which you, because you've known I feel like you knew from the beginning in a very like big magic bubble kind of way, like you got this idea almost fully delivered to you. It seemed like I'm going to write this poetry, but I'm going to adapt it to music. And I'm going to do that because I know as a poet that music has that much further of a reach, you know, it has that the marrying of those two things is what brings everybody to the dance floor, right? That's the beauty of it. But I think the wading through all of the truth you had to tell, like, it doesn't seem like there's one particular sweet spot in that. The sweet spot is the moving through it, right? I'm getting all of these things down and out of me, and I hope that they reach out, and I hope that that moving through this provides some sort of relief, because otherwise what the fuck am I doing here?
Right.
You know, that's true. I mean, I feel like I encourage people, and I tell myself every day, you have to move through this, you know, not around, not away through. But I'm gritting my teeth the whole time. Like, ooh, there better be like gold roads and mansions, or I'm going to be so pissed. You know, like I'm just, you're trying to hold on, and also trying to reach other people and say, like, I lived through this. And if we've found each other, you probably are living through something too.
Yeah, absolutely. Boy, that's the other R, is a reward. We didn't have to talk about it. Is there a reward on the other? I don't know. I know what you're
saying.
There
better be, especially if I'm choosing redemption over revenge. I feel like if I have to take the high road, there better be a higher stack for me. Like, I'm not doing this selflessly.
It's interesting you guys put it this way, like with the forgiveness. Oh my God. Like, just yes. Like, right before pandemic, I lost it. Like, I just wasn't okay. And then I got into therapy and yada, yada, yada. Like, for me, the reward has been, like, I'm a bit of a hypochondriac, too. So, like, illness is a big trigger for me. So, normally, with a new disease like COVID-19, that would have sent me spiraling, right? But I had done October, November, I'd already done almost like 6 months of work up until, you know, we went locked down in like March, right? And I wasn't panicking, and I was so confused as to why I wasn't panicking about this. But it's like I had gotten myself in such a centered place, but also I realized, like, oh, the world is now just like matching up with like my normal state of being. Like, I'm always fucking freaking out. I always know something is not right. And it's like, I always thought something was wrong with me. And then I realized, like, when you went back to saying I wouldn't be embarrassed to tell people I broke my wrist, like, mental health is just health, right? Like, we're all depressed and anxious because of circumstantial stuff. I'm not broken. There's nothing wrong with me. Like, I'm responding in a very appropriate way to, like, what is going on in the world outside, right? And so it's like, the reward for me has been, like, I've had almost 2 years of no panic attacks, like, at all. Like, and it's because I work from home. I don't have to go into the office anymore, which was like a big panic inducer for
me. You fought for. You really advocated for yourself to be able to have that before it was a remote job in the first place.
Exactly. Like, I got notes from my doctors, and I said, look, like, they said Vanessa's a good worker. She can work, but she needs to work at home. Like, and I think that saved me. I really think that saved me. And continuing to have, I don't know, maybe the control of my environment during pandemic, because I was just in this bubble, gave me a lot of time to heal. And I didn't have to be in other people's spaces. So now when I do re-enter the world, like, I'm in such a more stable place. But like, when I think about reward, like, what is on the other side of this? Like, I just, like, my reward has been like not panicking. Because, like, I literally was in a place where it's like, I can no longer live like this. I never wanted to die. My fear is of dying. But, like, you can't function and live like this as a person. Like, it was so not okay.
Man, I'm just I'm taking notes of stuff you're saying because it's really resonating with me. But, like, I love what you said, that, like, it seemed like the world had just kind of come up to our level of stress. I had that same experience. I was like, well, I sort of felt like, well, finally, everybody, you're paying attention. Have you not been paying attention to what is going on? But then that made me think, why do we understand this? But I think this is part of being an artist, is that artists train ourselves and open ourselves, we purposely shed and tear open our chest so that we experience more and are more aware. I mean, we are training ourselves to be empaths. Certainly many of us are empaths anyway, but part of making good art is to be able to, as Mary Oliver says, observe and report back, right? So like to be able to observe and to understand and to experience it and feel it and then tell other people about it in a way with the hope of connecting. Well, shoot, when you put yourself in that kind of loop, we're going to feel it. We're going to feel it harder. So I think I experienced that too. Just like, thank God, everybody's finally getting on the same page. And I think it's been going to be good for us, our society, as just as humankind, that we're have opened up to talk about how people are actually really feeling and mental health and all the kinds of things that have been just cloaked in shame and stuff. And there's no reason for it. I think about a friend of mine told me one time, he said, when I was in college, I got so depressed. I went to bed for 6 months and I laughed. And he's like, I'm not kidding. I was like, God, I heard that. I mean, and you know, you'd never know that now. If you looked at him now, you think, oh, he's this huge successful person and stuff. But, everybody experiences things, and God forbid you have trauma, like trauma, whatever that could be, or deep loss. You add that on top there and it's just a pile. You can hardly crawl out from under.
And as good workers, we're expected to just power through. You know, you're supposed to go back to work after 3 months after giving a baby. Oh, your mom died today. See you in the office later. You know what I mean? Like, this is our culture of work, and you're somehow a bad person if you need time. And I like that you mentioned that your friend said, you know, he just slept for 6 months. And our literature is matching up with that. Like Otessa Moshfegh put out the My Year of Rest and Relaxation. Mm-hmm. And the main character in that book basically tries to sleep for like an entire year, right? Like all the ills of like what is going on, whether she was like taking all these pills or just like, I feel like our art is now matching up with like the reality of people's like lived experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
The people calling for peace have become so much more my heroes in this way too, right? Because now I feel like as artists, like I definitely think there's a practice of intentionally being present, but I, you know, whether artists are born or made, I feel like when you truly claim that word as part of your identity, you're recognizing that you hear something at a like a different frequency than most people hear it, right? And so it's kind of like everybody else started hearing the sirens, is what I felt like, right? But they're so loud in reacting to the sirens that it's totally changed my art, in that now I want to be very quiet. And I want you to come very close, because I'm not going to say this very loudly.
Yeah, I feel like that too. Like I yearn for, and then all the years of touring, of course, I feel like since I was a kid, I've been standing on the stage going, look at me, look at me, look at me, look at me. I have something to say. And now I'm just like, oh my God, I just want to be at home in my office right here at this desk in my little comfy reading nook, just quiet, peaceful, calm, happy. I feel better than I have probably most of my life. And most of that has to do with just bringing down the volume of my own outside voice. My inner voice is still very rich. In fact, in some ways I'm hearing it better because I'm not out there on the stage. I think when we were touring every night doing, you know, 150 to 200 shows a year, like you get so focused outward that it's hard to write. Like I didn't write very deep things during that decade. I did a lot of great performances and I had a lot of fun and wrote a lot of music, but wasn't doing this work that I'm doing now. And it's interesting how some of these old things you mentioned, you know, your mom died, you have to go back to work. Well, we're coming up on the 20th anniversary of my mom's death in February. And it has really, really been on my mind. I was a pretty young person when she died. And, you know, I lost a year of my life. I went to work. Like I look at my calendar because I keep all my old stuff, but I was working all the time as a commercial actress. So I'm going on, doing on camera, driving to Topeka, doing Payless commercials and blah, blah, blah. I don't know how I did it. I can think about that now. Because if you look at my diary, it's just filled with tears and tears and heartache. And I was so angry. I couldn't understand why such a good person died. Like I just could not make sense of it. And I still still really haven't, but you know, like that's coming up again and it feels fresh again, you know? So people that have experienced trauma, and as artists, we often go to our trauma and write about it or try to understand it. It's not like you get through it once and then it goes away. You get through it and then you have a different level of understanding. And then you kind of go back to it again and maybe you see something new in it, or you have a new perspective as hopefully you're moving through it. But
I talked about this on Tuesday night. Because I feel like I just happened to write on this prompt, of lurking things lurking inside you unsaid. And I wrote about, thank you. But writing, like, I realized that on the page in the 10-minute time frame, and actually in a 5-minute time frame, because I was trying to work on my previous one because I was like hype about what I was writing. Anyway,
I do that too.
Yeah, I'm just like, ooh, but I want to keep on going on one. Fuck it. But it kind of came over me and I was like, oh, I know why I'm having a hard time like being with my art right now. And it's because I'm only doing it for myself. I don't need anyone to look at me anymore. I have no desire left in me to perform. And there's that feeling of like creating art in a performance way later on down the line, because that's the right medium. But there's a shift out of this need to be seen. Like my introspect keeps coiling in on itself and I need quiet. I need peace, you know, and there's no substitute and there's no pretending. I mean, even today's one of those days where I just like, I was around loving people, but I am hard to be around today because I just truly need to be alone, you know, and like you send out that kind of energy. I could sort of contain it before, but like since the pandemic, like, no, that energy shields outward and it's like, everybody go away.
Yeah. I love what you said about you, you know, it's almost like you're on stage saying, you know, I want you to hear me. I want to be heard. I have this need to be heard and understood. And now it's almost like your inner voice is saying, no, who you need to listen to is me. Listen, you need to listen to, I need to listen to myself for a while. And I don't need everybody else. I don't need to other people to hear it right now. I need to listen to myself.
Also, I think social media plays in a lot of that too, because it's like we're all constantly hearing other people's voices and pictures and opinions, and we're constantly like sharing, and to me that's the same thing. We're not allowing ourselves enough alone time with our own voice without all that other stuff filtering in, right? Like, what kind of writer would you be if you just sat in the room and wrote for a year and didn't share anything and didn't read anybody else's feedback or comments, or if you didn't see what other people, like comparing yourself to what other people are doing because you were seeing what they were posting, right? Like, we're really just not even ever alone because we're constantly doing that. So it's like, you know, I'm curious as to, like, now that I feel like I've evolved over these past couple of years, like, what would that look like if I even stepped away from that? Like, how much more can I hear my inner voice? Because I'm a Gemini sun and a Gemini rising. And I've been very much Gemini my entire life. I was an extrovert. I always wanted to like be center of attention. I'm at the party. I'm very talkative. I make friends everywhere I go. Like, I had a lot of Gemini characteristics. Well, I'm a Scorpio moon. And so it's like, I've been learning more about my Scorpion moon capabilities and qualities, because it's like, you know, the sun sign is like your exterior and how you like present to the world. And then like your moon sign is more your interior world. And that's where I feel like I've been living the past couple of years, you know? And it's like, I just want to retreat and being at the cabin where I was just writing and reading every day. And like that, I've never felt so good. I've never felt so good and right. And like, I was onto something. And it was, even when I didn't have internet, I could find internet to check in with my 30-day writing program. And I wrote better. I wrote more interesting. I was focused more. And then as soon as I got home, even though like I'm still just in my house, I'm still, the mode has changed because now I have internet constantly. I'm checking Instagram more. I'm on email. I'm at work. You know what I mean? Like, all this infiltration that comes in has pulled my focus away from what's inside.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Jen, I was going to, I totally agree with you. And I've been squeezing in, because I now have a big fat job now. So like, I'm trying to figure out how to get the writing in around that. And so I figured out, I've tried all different kinds of, you know, calendar ways to make this work, of schedules to find time. But what works is for me to just go away. So I'm going away to Eureka Springs. This will be, did four of them this year, and I scheduled it and put money aside for it. And I'm going again in November. That'll be the last time. And that's what I have to do too. I have to go away and get out of my house. It's just too hard. But Jen, I wanted to talk about something you said about that piece that you wrote on Tuesday. One of the things that you wrote in there that's totally topical to what we're talking about, you said in that piece that you had held accountable everybody that you needed to. You didn't have anybody new to hold accountable, or something like that. I'm not saying that. I'm paraphrasing.
You know what? You wrote it better than I did.
So I just thought that is so interesting, right? When we're talking about moving through trauma or moving through some of these old things, and what a sense of growth to say, I've just been in this place of pain for so long. And at some point you could just be like, oh, I think I'm going to now start talking about something else. I had a moment like that with my dad. So I'm older than you. So my story always started with, my dad left us when I was 12. This was literally like, where are you from? Tell me about yourself. Well, hi. Yeah. Well, I'm from Iowa. My dad left us when I was 12. This was the preface of everything. And it wasn't until I was probably 40 that I was like, I'm so sick of this story. I'm sick of this story. I don't actually want that to be my story. It's not my story. It's my dad's story. Why am I starting my story with my dad's action? And not only that, an action that I disagree with and don't respect. Why would I start my story that way? And it took me a while to figure out then what are the words I did that I want to say. But once I was able to, I had this mental image of like literally carrying bags before we had little pull rollers, you know, carrying these bags around and then just literally setting them down and walking away from them. Because like, that was so easy. Why could I do that today? And I couldn't do that 5 years ago. But I think
there's so much relevance to that, right? Like I asked my therapist, my first trauma therapist, that question in like a different way, right? Like I was like, why is this all happening now? And she was like, maybe this is the first time you've been safe enough to experience this. Right. And I was like, maybe you fuck yourself. Like it was like, okay. Well then I have to like, let it happen.
Yeah. Because thing we don't want is to stand in our own way once we get to that place. And how do you recognize it? Like,
exactly.
Well, I don't want to miss it. Like, oh, wait a minute. Am I getting better? Is this healthy?
That's so poignant though, that you said like, this isn't my story. Why am I repeating the story? And I'm so glad you used that bag reference, because my partner said that thing to me too. He's like, sometimes you can set the bag on the side of the highway and keep going. You don't even have to unpack that bag. You just drop it and go, because like, it's time, right? And you're like, that's not my story. And I want to tell a different story. And this is how I feel like we're all courting our own trauma. I've been writing about this, like, because we repeat those stories over and over again. It's like, we won't let them go. We are now courting the trauma. We are presenting it. You know what I mean? We're telling the sad story. Like, there's a million things you've done between when you were 12 and your dad left you, but this is what you've chose to present still, right? Like, it's so interesting.
Yeah. It is so interesting. Well, and Vanessa, I mean, we've talked about this on the pod before, but like, I was dealing with the emotions related to a breakup, and Vanessa just, she said to me like one day after listening to me for a long time, she was like, you're so much more interesting than the people you've been with. And I was like, okay, bitch, like, okay. But it forced me to like face, for the briefest of moments, shifting the narrative away from this thing I'd been obsessing over, this thing that you're just trying to make sense of. And it doesn't make sense because it was a mess. You know what I mean? Like, you can't put it back together. It wasn't together in the first place.
Yeah. If it made sense in the first place. Yeah. I mean, maybe you'd be still together, but it was a mess. So,
right.
Yeah, I'm glad that resonated with you, because like, I have a line in my, and a poem that says, you are not the most interesting thing that happened to me. And that's when I got to the point where I was like, where I was dropping that bag and moving on. I'm like, why am I holding on to this? Like, I had gotten to this point. I'm so far beyond it. Like I couldn't, I was no longer going to carry that with me. Like, you are no longer my story. You are not the most interesting thing that's happened to me. And I'm not going to continue to give you that spotlight.
Right. Well, and to Aaron's point about like the kind of, you know, the moving through and the like hope, you know, nobody really ever thinks, I don't think initially, about what it's going to feel like to be healed. in a way. Like the conversation of mental health has often been like, get help. But we never really finish that story up with like, it's not that you could stay in therapy for the rest of your life in any version of that. Some people just need that check-in. Some people do it, like regularly, irregularly, have somebody on call. I've reached a place recently where I feel like what I've accomplished with the therapists that I've had is done. And I'm stable and happy and healthy and where I want to be. So I'll call you if I need an appointment kind of thing. Right. But there's all of this like raging war anger going on for like three decades of my life. And then it was kind of like through therapy and writing and not doing as many drugs and being around healthier people and all those things, it started to dry up. And I don't know that I noticed it drying up. I was definitely trying to get it to dry up, but I was still fighting. And then it was like one day I just like there was nothing left to fight, you know, and you're just like, oh, I guess it's over. Cause I've got nothing left to say. Like it ran out of gas. And I was just like, oh, it's time to leave. And the beauty of that is everything. But then it's like, and welcome to the change of not knowing what the fuck is next. Like it's a totally different environment.
Completely different set of anxiety. It's triggers. I think sometimes too, what helps me and what I think might help more now that we're having this conversation is to like physically to manifest it in some physical way that you've kind of crossed that place. Like, you know, you went through communion when you were a kid or you have, you know, your whatever there, I don't know what I'm trying to say, to mark this passage, right? So I'm thinking about when I got married for the second time and it was really messy. My divorce was messy and it was messy for a long time. And it was a complicated, our relationship was complicated and long distance. And finally we got it all together and it was great, but it took about 4 years. And we were in Chicago getting ready to go on our honeymoon and we had our bags. I had my bag and he had his bag and everything. And we went to a luggage store in Chicago and bought two new bags and asked him if we could do this right there in the store. And we unpacked our suitcases in the store and repacked them in the new suitcases and then donated those bags right there in the moment and literally walked out of the store with new bags. And we're like, we are leaving our baggage in Chicago. Like, this is you and me starting fresh. Let's do something physically to mark that moment. And it sounds silly, but it was really powerful.
That's brilliant. And I'm such a big believer in like, in symbolic gestures like that. Like, yes. Even though like,
and the people writers, in the store were clapping and stuff. They're like, that's so great. We're like, yes, it is. Let's go. You know?
Oh God. I love that. I can just see this as like a great scene in the movie where the turn is happening and like just seeing you guys take that luggage out and put it in something new, you know, it's like buying a new bed or new set of sheets when you have a new lover, because you're like, I'm not about to bring this new love into this old messy bed. Right. Like,
yeah. You got to buy new panties, new dicks, new bras. Like I got a whole reset I got to do.
But like, I think it's really important because I do, rituals like that, like, you know, if you write all of the problems down on a piece of paper and burn it, right? Or like,
yes.
I sometimes take those ashes and I incorporate paint and I'll do a painting because I physically need to transform what is wrong into something new and pretty, whether it's transformation or not. It really is about the transformation. You know, it's like when I can't just get something out of me, you know, like when I ended a relationship with my best friend and everything I had to still get out of my head or the things I was repeating, you know, I wrote it all down, I burned it. And then I made this beautiful like moon painting out of it or something. You know what I mean? Like, and it's for nobody but me, but like, I need to see that physical transformation. I'm a very tactile, visual person, even though like I write, I'm a writer and I work with words, but like, I need the literal, like, something fucking changed. You know what I mean? It was yes. This and now it is this.
Yes.
And sometimes the power in writing too. Like, that's what I feel like I wrote all of my books about. Like, I have this pain and until I get it out of me, I'm not going to stop writing about it. And if you happen to be in a relationship with me and you exacerbate the pain from the first book, I'm going to rewrite it into another book. Cool, bitch.
That's a warning.
Until it's over.
That's- Yeah.
Listen, don't fuck with writers who don't know what you're doing, because we are a dangerous breed. You got to know, you know, you got to know what you're getting into. You could be immortalized as a villain.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. When I learned that in college, I told a story at a party to a playwright. He was a classmate, but and then I went to go see this little play that he was putting on. And sure as shit, that was my story. It was a really personal story, repeated word for word. And I was just sitting in the audience like, oh, I was so mad. I was like, I can't believe that you told that story. He's like, come on, you knew I'm a writer. You know? And I was like, yeah, but. And he's like, yeah, but. You know, like, okay.
That's
okay.
Shitty, but also like, yeah.
I know. Like, I should have known better. Like, you know. Beware. So
I mean, but also parents should have told her, if you're raising writers, like the more you fuck us up. I mean, I think the people who raise writers are like not even going to hear this podcast.
You know, but like, this is like a great way for children to actually take back control, because like if you're going to be a shitty parent and you're raising writers, like they're going to write about it. So fucking get your shit together.
Right. It's like the social media broadcasting before there was social media broadcasting, where you're like, just you wait. In my tell-all memoir, I'm going to rat you out. I'm going to let everybody know. I think that this piece that you've written, though, Erin, it's so deeply introspective, and it has all the chaos of dreams, and it has all of the struggles and the realities. I feel like it's such a powerful piece to kind of lead us anywhere. So, like, what other things or what else are you including in this? Do you have other tracks? Have you, is this the first final piece, or are you like in the midst of this project right now?
Yeah, we've got several tracks. Another one of my favorite ones that is called Elegant Degradation. And so when I was going through this, when I was writing all this, I was doing a lot of just scientific study too, because I like to turn to science to try to understand things, because science is so much more black and white. So I have this piece called Elegant Degradation that has a really cool track underneath it too. It's just all about, I read this phrase, elegant degradation, and it's describing what happens to a machine that doesn't look like it's falling apart. So it's what called, instead of like, you know, the wheels are falling off or the door is resting and stuff like that, it looks perfectly fine and it will continue to have output until it fails in one of two ways, either immediately like that, like one day it just stops, or it can like gradually, you know, decay, but never on the outside, always on the inside, and you won't know what's wrong. But I was like the hard stop, you know, like, what's going on? You look fine. Everything looks good. Your life looks like it's going just fine. What could possibly be wrong with your life? And I thought that's how I felt misunderstood a lot, because people were like, what do you have to complain about? I mean, you're in a happy second marriage, and you get to travel all over the country, and you get to be an artist for a living, and you're healthy. And like, what do you have to complain about? Why should you be unhappy? And I almost felt like it was hard for people to even understand that I see the world from the inside out. You know, we don't get to look at our lives from the outside like we all look at each other, right? And we spend way too much damn time looking at each other. We should keep our eyes on our own page. We'd be a lot happier. So
I agree. I couldn't agree with you more. I think there's nothing that makes me feel worse about my body or my bank account than Instagram. Like, I want to be on the gram for mental health and to see what my friends are up to. But if I fall down a rabbit hole, which happens whenever I'm trying to detach from the world, oh my God, I walk away like fused with capitalism, because I got to fix myself. I got to get the right, yeah. Like, something's got to change, or I've already ordered something to improve my condition. And it's just like, it's so fucking bad.
We cannot buy our way to feeling better. And like you said, it's like, keep your eyes on your own page. Like, I am all for the party of mind your own fucking business, right? Like, and not making assumptions, right? Because like you said, oh, people look at you on the outside and it's like, oh, you're fine. You know, I think of a lot of people who like deal with like autoimmune disorders, or like my partner has Crohn's or like whatever. Mm-hmm. And everyone's like, oh, whatever, you look fine. So there's nothing wrong, right? It's like, if you physically, like, you're a beautiful woman, Erin, like you have had successes, you know, people want to look at you and be like, oh, you're fine. Like, you're healthy, you're beautiful, you're working, as if those are the only things that matter. So like, nothing else could possibly be wrong.
Or I don't get to have feelings or re-depressed, you know, because right, exactly. you don't get to have it because, and so that's what this elegant degradation is all about, is this feeling of like, I'm falling apart on the inside, but on the outside, my output stays. In fact, as long as somebody needs me, I will keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going. The output doesn't get diminished. So anyway, that one, the track's done, but I haven't done the vocal yet. Then I have one called, I Have a Crush on Science, which is kind of a lighter piece, but it's about my fascination with science and my wishing that sometimes we all live in the gray so much. And sometimes I wish things were a little bit more black and white. It'd be easier. Like back long ago when I was in high school and I was a hardcore Christian, I got, you know, born again in the Lord with my boyfriend. And it was easier then because it was all black and white. Like there was,
like you do.
You know, 16, it's a tender age. But, you know, I didn't have to worry about anything because, you know, it was all right there for me. Didn't have to make any decisions. Didn't have to worry about anything. You know, that went away, unfortunately. And then I'm trying to think what else.
Who knew it wasn't that easy?
Yeah. So anyway, yeah. Go ahead.
Do you think though, like in another lifetime, if you weren't a writer, actress extraordinaire, like, do you think you would have been a scientist of some sort? Like, do you have interests mm-hmm. like that?
You know, my mom was a nurse. And so people are always saying, were you going to be a nurse like your mom? And I was like, oh, no way, man. Like she'd come home. She worked so hard. She'd have like this spray of something on her white thing. And I'm like, ah, and she's like, don't ask. I'm like, I'm not going to. I'm kind of squeamish that way. So, I do like science. I don't know if I'd be a scientist, but I worked in the science field for about 11 years and I loved it. I was always the least educated person in the room, which is a great thing to be because you never have to put on airs because you're always like, I'm actually working with like rocket scientists. So
right.
I have a BA in, you know, in arts
theater.
Degree.
I'm here for the outsider perspective.
Yeah. Which was great. I loved that. I loved the way that their minds think. I think that the curiosity and the asking the why. I love that. Yeah. And so anyway, but I've got several pieces that the music is done. We have some that we're still working on the music that hasn't been completed yet. I think all the pieces, you know, you don't know when kind of a body of work is done. I was just thinking the other day, Jen, I think it's kind of to what you were saying. I kind of feel like this body of work is done and I'm going on my writing. I call it advance, not retreat, in November. And I think I'm going to edit these. I think this is the end of this body because I'm starting to write and think about some other things. And this anxiety is feeling still really real to me. I mean, but I'm not experiencing it anymore. And that's actually a great place to recognize healing, to recognize movement forward. Yes. But I hope that some people find it comforting to understand that other people feel this way too, and that there is an other side of it. Maybe not the redemption, but more movement or transformation, I think, is really at the other side of that. Something I did want to say about Tossed and Found, in the back half of it, I talk about that wedding, that ring. That's this ring that I'm wearing. And what it was before, sometimes in my worst moments, it's the women, even the women I don't know. So when I say the grandmothers, I mean sort of like that in that spirit woo-woo world. Like I literally laid in that bed and sort of conjured them, like asked for their help. And I could literally feel them around me with their hands on my body, touching me, calming me, just in that way that mothers do. And, you know, I have felt that multiple times in my life. In particular, in that one moment, it was so real. I could almost feel them in the room with me. And so this ring, when I was getting married the second time, my grandmother, my mom's mom, had a ring that my sister and I both shared. So she had it in Texas. And I asked her, I said, could I use that? Because I would like to wear grandma's ring. Well, there was some complications around that, the way that family, there can be complications. And so Jeff said, we'll go get another ring. That's fine. You know, so we bought a ring. But then as I was going through some old jewelry, this little box of things, out from this thing felt two things, a little envelope that had this in it. This is the wedding band. My sister has the solitaire but this is the actual wedding band of my grandma's. And I forgot that I had it. And it was in a little envelope with my mom's handwriting on it. And this is a theme that has happened more than once. My mother has left me notes in the universe. 20 years later, I found it, right? And then the second thing was this ring popped out. It was pitch black. And I had a tiny scrap of paper wrapped around it like this. So I unscrolled the paper. And I'm reading it. It's tiny handwriting. It said, this ring was worn by my mother at her wedding. And I wore it at my wedding. And I'm thinking, oh, this must be grandma. Because maybe this solitaire came later because she got married in 1929 in the middle of the Depression. Like, I don't know how they would have ever found, had that kind of diamond. I mean, I can't imagine that diamond was purchased in 1929. You know what I mean? Knowing my family and stuff. And anyway, so I got to thinking about it. So I did a little more digging around. I come to find out this was actually written by my great-grandmother. So like it was my great-mother talking about my great-grandmother, whose name was Katie Robb, who was married in 1875 with this rose gold ring. So she was married in 1875. 29 years later, Beulah, her daughter-in-law, was married with it. 29 years later, her daughter-in-law was married with it. That was Gladys. And then, yeah, 29, 29, 29. So 1875, 1902, and 1929. And then 1956, my mom was married, which is freaky. The numbers, the way those numbers line up. Why? I felt like that. When I felt like that, it was like the grandmothers were just like, girl, we are here physically here for you in the spirit world. We are here. I know that sounds really woo woo, but
no, it's like you called on the ancestors and they're there, and we should talk to them more. Like we should talk to our ancestors more. We should talk to the dead more. We should invite them in and be aware of their presence. And I love that you speak their names, Katie, Beulah, Gladys, like mm-hmm. in the piece, like that's so important, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So oh, it's so beautiful. I love that story.
Yeah. So that's what that part is about. And then understand that I was sleeping under this quilt and that it was a crazy quilt that was made from, you know, remnants and scraps that were kept in a rag bag and reused and made. Like I just slept. Once I began to understand that I'm just one piece in that. And that to me is that feeling of safety or belonging. And that's when I feel unsafe, when I feel like I don't belong and I feel like I don't have anyone, that starts to trigger that anxiety. But I always belong because I belong to the greater family of the grandmothers of the world. Right. And it was just that remembrance of that. And that's really what that second half of that poem. So from this intense feeling of loneliness and like just being absolutely adrift to feeling completely surrounded and loved.
Thanks for listening to Confessing Animals. Make sure you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review so more people can find us. And if you want to support the show or get access to the extended video casts, join us on Patreon, confessinganimalspodcast.com.